You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 4th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, what are the chances of a pause in fighting in Gaza before Ramadan? We examine the prospects as the US Vice President calls for an immediate ceasefire. Also ahead,
I'm working on a concrete and substantial G7 summit. We intend first and foremost to reaffirm the rule-based international order, defending freedom and building peace for Ukraine.
Italy's Prime Minister visits Washington, where President Biden says they've got each other's backs. Also, a decade since flight MH370 disappeared from our skies, we hear from one woman who's devoted her professional life to discovering what happened.
I think in my mind I've made some adjustments. I still think that there was a plan A that did not work, and it turned into a plan B that became a disaster.
Plus the Taliban's plans to build a cricket stadium and Monday's papers too. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. South Korea is to take legal action against trainee doctors who've gone on strike. Up to 4,000 prisoners have escaped jail after armed gangs stormed the main prison in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. And Switzerland has voted to give pensioners an extra month's payment in a referendum focusing on living standards for the elderly. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the US Vice President has called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Kamala Harris also urged Israel to significantly increase the flow of aid to civilians, saying people in Gaza are now starving. Meanwhile, mediators trying to bring about a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war reconvened in Cairo yesterday. Israel and Hamas delegations were also expected to arrive, but Israel stood firm, saying it won't send a delegation until it gets a full list of hostages who are still alive and being held by Hamas. To tell us more, I'm joined now by Christopher Phillips, Professor of International Relations at Queen Mary University of London and author of Battleground, 10 Conflicts That Explain the New Middle East. A very good morning to you, Chris.
Good morning.
Good to have you back in the studio. Just let's talk about this comment made by the US Vice President yesterday, not long ago, calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. That's a suggestion that America is making its voice heard a little louder now, isn't it?
To a point, yes. This is probably the most critical a senior US official has been of Israel since the war began. An indication, perhaps, of the Biden government's frustration at Israel's reluctance to engage in ceasefire talks, its reluctance to improve the delivery of aid, and especially with all the attacks that occurred over the weekend on people queuing for aid that were reportedly led to up to 115 Palestinians killed. There is this an indication of a bit of a shift from Washington towards Israel, really putting a little bit more pressure to move forward on this.
And how much were the airdrops part of what you've just said? Because Joe Biden this weekend said that aid flowing to Gaza is not nearly enough, and airdrops can't replace aid convoys delivered over land. But symbolically, the pictures were powerful enough, weren't they, to make an impression?
Yes, they were. And aid agencies have actually been quite critical of the US for making this move, saying this isn't a substitute for improved aid. You know, airdrops don't distribute accurately. It's not a systematic way of getting aid to the right people. But it was an indication to the US public that the US is serious about helping the people suffering in Gaza. And it's symbolic as a sign to Israel, saying, look, we really want you to be seen to be in a more difficult position on this. And that's why you get those quite striking images of the black parachutes on the beaches.
And when you have the UN also saying that Israel needs to make aid more accessible to those who are trapped, How much is there a likelihood that Israel will listen to any of this? Or is this always, is this continuing, or is Israel just going to continue on the path that it generally tends to choose?
Well, the UN has been critical of Israel from the very beginning. So I don't think the UN has a great deal of leverage or is widely respected by the Israeli government. The US position is more significant. The US is the main arms supplier of Israel. It is a significant diplomatic supporter that blocks criticism of Israel at the UN Security Council. So the US does have leverage, but has been reluctant to use it for various reasons since the conflict began. You have got the other side of it, which, of course, is the Israeli government, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been very intransigent thus far. His coalition partners are even more hawkish than he is. So, and they are pretty adamant that there shouldn't be a ceasefire, and you know, the aid question is far less significant than the military question.
And one wonders whether the aid question being raised this weekend, and the airdrops and the reset, you know, the re-emergence of the call for more help to be given to civilians, has something to do with that catastrophic disputed incident on involving an aid convoy in which 100 people died last week. Whether the causes of all the injuries and the deaths is still uncertain, isn't it? There are those who say that it was the Israelis who opened fire. There is evidence that people had gunshot wounds when they were being treated in hospital. But there is also the suggestion that these people might simply have just been crushed.
Yes, it's sadly one of the classic incidents you get in a contested conflict zone. Sadly, very common. The Gaza Health Ministry, controlled by Hamas, say up to 115 Palestinians were killed, mostly of gunshot wounds. The UN seemed to corroborate some of that, saying that some of the people that were treated with gunshot wounds. But the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have said, no, actually, the vast majority were killed in a crush because of people rushing to get access to aid. And a limited number, a very small number, were killed when they were supposedly threatening IDF troops that were then shot. But they're saying it's a handful that were shot rather than the majority of the over 100 that you mentioned.
Let's move to efforts this week to try to bring about a ceasefire. We had mediators reconvening yesterday in Cairo. Israeli and Hamas delegations were supposed to be there. By all accounts, Hamas is there now. But the Israelis are saying, no, we're not going until we know the full list of hostages who are still alive.
Yes, we're getting slightly mixed messages on this. Over the weekend, in fact, before the weekend, Joe Biden, whilst holding an ice cream, said that he expected a ceasefire within the next week. And later on over the weekend, the US official said that Israel had, quote, more or less accepted a deal that was presented by the mediators. Now we're getting a degree of pushback from Israel. Again, it's those coalition partners that are reluctant to meet Hamas's conditions. Hamas's conditions are things such as a full withdrawal from the Gaza Strip temporarily, which they're very reluctant to do. And Hamas, in turn, are reluctant to accept Israel's conditions, which is a full list of the surviving hostages that were taken on October the 7th. So there's still quite a way to go, and it's not clear which way it's going to turn.
Indeed, because Hamas hasn't backed away from the position that a temporary truce must be the start of a process towards ending the war altogether. There is no sign that Israel is going to come anywhere near this, at the moment at least.
No, and Israel, the Netanyahu government, have stated very clearly from the beginning that their war goal is the complete removal and destruction of Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And that is a long way from Hamas's position of trying to negotiate a ceasefire that leads to some kind of deal that will see Hamas remain in the Gaza Strip. So, yeah, we're a long way away.
And there would also be the requirement of a pullback of Israeli forces from northern Gaza and the return of residents displaced, pushed down towards the south of the Strip. I mean, what is the likelihood of Israel agreeing to either of those demands?
Well, it seems unlikely at this moment in time, especially the question of the allowing civilians and presumably unofficially some Hamas officials back into Gaza City, where they've largely been removed. Israel is very concerned that that area of northern Gaza can't become once again a launch pad for Hamas to either launch rockets or ground troop attacks into Israel itself. But of course, it's the most populated part of the Gaza Strip, and Hamas and its supporters and everyday Palestinians living in Gaza want to return to their homes. So it's an area of dispute that it seems quite difficult to see how they'll get beyond that. One presumes at some point that Gaza City will have to be repopulated. So it's a question of how the mediators, the United States, Qatar, Egypt, can manage to smooth that issue with Israel. And I think once again, it's going to probably come back in the long term to the position of Hamas in Gaza, whether or not there's any situation in which Hamas could remain in Gaza in some capacity, or whether or not Israel will continue its bombardment, continue its attack until such a point where Hamas can be cajoled into leaving.
And of course, if there is a pause for, they're saying, what, 6 weeks, it would make it harder for Israel to resume attacks, wouldn't it?
Yes, and that's one of the concerns that Israel clearly has. Before, we've had a single week troop in November, and even by the end of that, it was far harder for Israel to maintain international sympathy, really, following the October 7th attacks, when it became clear that this was going to be a quite harsh and aggressive assault that was pretty indiscriminate in Gaza. A six-week truce, which would allow press and allow aid agencies into Gaza, would make it even harder for Israel to then relaunch a bombardment and attack on the same scale that we've seen so far.
And you mentioned the fact that the Qataris and the Egyptians are closely involved in all this in terms of the negotiation. I mean, how important is this for Egypt and for Qatar? I mean, Egypt being absolutely on the border. How much is it for the wider region to be seen to be bringing about some sort of ceasefire?
Yes, for the states that are involved in the negotiations and what we might call the wider, quote unquote, moderate Middle Eastern states, which is mostly those that aren't aligned with Iran. So not just Qatar and Egypt, but also Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states like the UAE. It's important both for their domestic populations, for them to be who are very sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, but also for their sort of international clout, to sort of show the United States and the wider region that actually, this is their neighbourhood. They are able to influence the actors on the ground. They are able to end this or contribute to an end to this horrendous conflict that's lasted for over 5 months now.
Chris Phillips, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. AM in Rome, 7:12 here in London now. We've got each other's backs. Reassuring words from the US President Joe Biden as he hosted the Italian Prime Minister on Friday. Giorgia Meloni reportedly discussed shared priorities, such as support for Ukraine and containing the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. Signora Meloni then headed north across the border to Toronto to meet the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Well, to find out a little bit more, I'm joined now by Amy Kasmin, who's a Financial Times Rome correspondent. A very good morning to you, Amy.
Good morning.
So this was a moment when Giorgia Meloni really seized the international stage, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. Italy has got the presidency of the G7 this year. And so that is really an important platform for Italy and Giorgia Meloni personally to project herself as a player on the global stage. Now, this is not Giorgia Meloni's first visit to Washington, D.C. In fact, she was there last year as well. So she was there this time in her role as the G7 president. But it's interesting to see that she and Joe Biden really do seem to have developed quite some rapport. When she came to power in late 2022, there were a lot of concerns about where she would stand and what the relationship would be like with the U.S. In the past, she had been seen as an admirer of Trump. Steve Bannon had been invited to a political festival that Giorgia Meloni had organized when she was an opposition leader. So there was a lot of concerns about what would happen with the relationship with the United States. But after taking power, Georgia proved that she was a very strong supporter of Ukraine, which is, of course, the top issue or one of the top issues on, you know, the international agenda from Washington's perspective. And she demonstrated that she really was concerned about Ukraine's fight. She made her own trip to Kiev to meet Zelensky. She's hosted Zelensky. And so I think a lot of the concerns that that they initially had about where she would come down on these international issues, particularly on Ukraine, have been reassured. And in fact, there seems to be a genuine warmth between Georgia and US President Joe Biden.
Indeed, how does Georgia Meloni do this? Because they said when she was elected, she very much domestically, at least, has a right-wing protectionist approach to things. And yet, on her travels in North America this weekend, she looked like an international stateswoman.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there people who support her say that, you know, that many people got it wrong about her and about her political skills. There's no doubt that she's a very charismatic individual with a strong ability to connect with others, maybe even, you know, with whom she may not share all, you know, complete political sympathies, and everything may not be in alignment with all their views, but on a human level, she is able to connect with people. We've seen that with her ability to forge a good working relationship with Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission. And, you know, politically, Giorgia Meloni had, you know, spent a long time attacking Brussels, and then she went off and, you know, appeared to charm Ursula, and they now have kind of a strong working relationship. And likewise, I think she does have kind of strong interpersonal skills. She's a warm and charming person, and people seem to warm up to her. But on the political level, I think it's important to say that while she has a certain amount of protectionism at home, there is no doubt that from the get-go, unlike some others in her coalition who have a long history of really strong pro-Russia sympathies, she, from the get-go, was really sympathetic to Ukraine and absolutely clearly outraged at the invasion when it occurred in 2022. She was at a conservative convention in the US very soon after, and she was absolutely fiery in her denunciations of the invasion and her you know, strong support for Ukraine. I think that in her ideology, the most important thing is like the nation and the sovereignty of a nation. And to her, this invasion was absolutely a brazen violation of kind of what she holds dear politically. So she's been absolutely unwavering on this, on the Ukraine issue.
Tell us a little bit more about the perception of Europe as a result of Giorgia Meloni's trip to both the United States and Canada this weekend, given the fact that as we head towards November and a presidential election in the United States and the possibility of the return of Donald Trump, the European Union or Europe itself needs to make sure that it can feel it appears to be standing on its own two feet, that it doesn't need that famous transatlantic relationship, which it perhaps it used to. I mean, how much does Giorgia Meloni's visit underscore the vitality of this relationship, and indeed the way that the United States and Europe together can address global challenges such as Ukraine, such as Gaza?
Well, of course, as you say, there's tremendous concern within Europe about the possible return of Donald Trump in Washington after November's elections. And I don't think anyone really has an illusion that somehow Europe can completely be fine if the US absolutely disconnects. NATO depends on America's nuclear deterrence to protect it overall. There is a lot of pressure on Europe to step up its defense spending, to better coordinate its military, to do more to ensure its own security. So there's a lot of anxiety, and I don't think anyone in Europe really has some illusion that, you know, if this relationship breaks down, that they'll be fine. I think, in fact, there is some hope that maybe people like Giorgia Meloni, who have been able to, I mean, in a way, she has been able to work by partisanly. She has shown a political deftness and skills to be able to interact with interlocutors from across a wide political spectrum, which is interesting. It's something that, you know, politicians used to be able to do to try to find common ground. Of course, the world has become more polarized. But in fact, she has had in the past relations with the Republican establishment, with, you know, Trump's ex-advisor Steve Bannon, yet she's been able to work with Joe Biden. So in fact, if Trump comes back to power, Giorgia Meloni's role as a potential European interlocutor for with Washington on Europe's behalf could actually become more important.
And finally, briefly, if you don't mind, Amy, we've talked about a lot about the United States, but what about Canada? Because on Saturday, her meeting was with Justin Trudeau in Toronto, again, G7 being a priority in the discussions. But how warm and indeed how vital is that relationship?
You know, I think that, of course, Canada is always an important country to as a member of. I think Canada is a country that Italy would like to continue to do business with. And I mean, they did sign a bilateral agreement to continue to develop relations on areas of common ground. And unfortunately, I think they were supposed to do some kind of public event and where they were going to have a tour of a museum together. That was canceled. And but I think that, you know, obviously, Italy would like to continue to have kind of friendly ties with Canada.
Amy Kesman, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. You're listening to Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is a journalist and geopolitics expert, Latika Burke. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Emma.
Looking bright-eyed and bushy-tailed for Monday morning.
As are you.
Right. OK, here we go. What's in the papers?
Well, it's pretty hard to miss this story in the Times this morning, where they have detailed how the Russians were able to intercept NATO-allied communication about operations in Ukraine. Specifically, the head of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, dialed into a call using his telephone from a hotel room in Singapore to discuss really serious military operations in Ukraine, including revealing how the French deliver their long-range missiles to the Ukrainians, including confirming that British troops are on the ground helping train Ukrainians, and going into the split that clearly exists within the German armed forces and the German government, which is holding off on delivering these Taurus long-range missiles to Germany. Now, last week, Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, Emma, revealed that one of the reasons he didn't want to send these Taurus missiles was because he would have to send German troops to help operate them, thereby confirming that the British and French had also sent their troops to Ukraine. So the Germans have made an absolute right royal hash of this, and the fury within the NATO allies is really clear, and I guess it's best summed up by this quote from Ben Wallace, a former defence secretary. Of course, you wouldn't hear too much criticism from the government today, but Ben Wallace was only the defence secretary until a few months ago, and he is very seriously critical of the Germans, saying, well, they're penetrated by the Russians, and this just goes to show how we can't trust them on intelligence.
Well, it seems like a really clumsy and basic error to dial from a mobile phone in a hotel room in Singapore via WebEx. It is just absolutely baffling, given the fact that the majority of any private company you deal with won't even often deal with the likes of Zoom, which is to the majority of people pretty safe. But
absolutely,
the fact that, you know, you'll use a really easy off-the-shelf application.
Our private companies have more security requirements of us as employees than what is being used here by the head of the German Royal Air Force. I mean, sorry, not the Royal Air Force, different country.
Luftwaffe.
Yes, indeed, the Air Force. A bit too early Monday morning. Yeah.
One thing that's been brought up also by the former chairman of the Commerce Defence Committee here in the UK is Tobias Elwood, who's saying, you know, why did Russia spill the beans on this? Why do they share this? They want to show that efforts are being made for the military to pursue this, to agitate politics in Germany. It's that typical Russia playbook, make people unstable.
Yes, the playbook, as you describe, is Putin and his cronies find the fractures that already exist within our societies and seek to drive those apart and expose them even further. There is a counter view to this, not included in this article, but I have seen from some former NATO officials out there speculating, well, what was also intercepted were plans to target the Kerch Bridge that connects Crimea. And this is a good thing because it shows Russia that these plans are well underway and Ukraine has a plan to do this. And if they have the weaponry that's given to them, they could pull that off. Not so sure. I think this is a very, very damaging leak from the Germans. And Tobias Elwood is correct in stating here that this is part of the Russian way of showing this fracture amongst the Allies. I mean, nobody can think that NATO has had a good week. And of course, this comes as the US is depriving Ukraine new aid and Ukraine is ceding battlefield advantage every day now since the fall of Avdiivka.
Let's talk a little bit about an article in The Telegraph today, by means of context. On Wednesday, the United Kingdom's Chancellor sets the government's budget. And there is an enormous amount of political horseplay here, given the fact that we are in an election year. And so Jeremy Hunt, Chancellor, needs to appease the people who are going to vote for him. Will increasing business class airfares actually help people vote him back into office?
I was stunned by this headline in The Telegraph this morning because going after the rich and the wealthy is a fairly well-trodden tactic, I would think.
From the left.
Mm-hmm. Even from the right these days. But Emma, I haven't quite seen anyone willing to make an example of those who fly business. But that's what it looks like, according to this article in The Telegraph today, written by Daniel Martin, that the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, is considering. He might increase the duty specifically on business class airfares, not airfares generally, just the business class ones, and try and raise some money here to fund a 2p tax cut. So a really, really interesting positioning there. They're also going after things particularly like nom-dom status, something that Labor's already earmarked it wants to do, and potentially taxing those who have second homes and let them out for holidays. So you can see that's a real Robin Hood budget from the Tories. Electorally, I'm not sure they do necessarily lose their own voters who might be flying business class, but it does really underline as we go into this election year, Emma, just how much the left are trying to copy the Tories, but also how much the Tories are trying to copy the left.
Indeed. And when the press are trying to work out how to shape this narrative, the Telegraph, which is, let Derry say it, is naturally a Tory-based newspaper, to seize on something as immediately recognisable as a business class airfare, it may not gather all the extra money that the government needs to keep the lights on, but it is something which is symbolically important, isn't it? And this is something that the left will seize upon.
I think the danger for the Conservatives is they're already losing a lot of their own voters to reform potentially on issues like migration. And in this country, you don't have compulsory voting like you do in my native Australia. So I think there's a risk for the Conservatives that people just don't bother. They don't bother to turn out. They might not vote Labor. They might not even vote Reform. But if they don't turn out, that's as good as a dead vote for the Conservatives.
Finally, we have but a mere matter of seconds to talk about an enormous dune in Morocco that is hugely important. I didn't know about this dune, so please tell us a little bit more.
Well, I always thought a dune was a sand dune, but turns out you can call these ones star dunes because when you look at them from on top, they look like stars with arms. Now, some scientists, including from the UK, have teamed up to go to Morocco and study this enormous star dune that exists. They found the base of it is rooted with vegetation, so obviously existing in a different climate when vegetation was there and it was a bit wetter, 9,000 years old, but the top is only about 1,000 years old.
Natika Burke, thank you for that. The time here in London is 7:30. A quick look now at the latest headlines. South Korea is to take legal action against trainee doctors who have gone on strike. The health minister warned that authorities will start inspecting hospitals. Around 7 out of 10 doctors have gone on strike over plans to increase admissions to medical school. Around 4,000 prisoners have escaped jail after armed gangs stormed the main prison on Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. It follows the latest outbreak in violence, where gangs control up to 80% of the city. Police in Zurich have stepped up security measures at Jewish sites after a serious knife attack on an Orthodox Jewish man. A 15-year-old Swiss teenager was arrested for inflicting life-threatening injuries on the man in the centre of the city on Saturday night. Switzerland has voted to give pensioners an extra month's payment in a referendum focused on living standards for the elderly. Three quarters of voters rejected raising the state pension to 66. The Swiss government has warned it will be unable to meet rising costs. And Israel has changed the lyrics to its Eurovision Song Contest entry. The competition's organisers had barred the song October Rain over apparent references to the attack on Israel by Hamas on October the 7th. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, this Friday marks 10 years since the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, one of the greatest mysteries of aviation history. Throughout this week on The Globalist, we'll be looking back on that day with those who've closely covered the event over the years. And we'll begin our series with Florence Tachonghi, who's a French journalist and author of The Disappearing Act, The Impossible Case of MH370. Monocle's Chris Chermak began by asking Florence when she realised that this story would take over her life.
Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.99.
I think that it is when I decided to revisit the story for the first anniversary. Again, it was for a double page that we published in Le Monde. And at that time, I went back to KL and I tried to understand better who the captain was, because I thought he would be a key. I mean, everyone knew he would be key in any plane accident, but also in his case, he had been smeared and there were all kinds of rumors about him. So I wanted to clear that, which I did in January 2015. And then we published this double page and I really understood then that story was rotten, if I may say. And from then on, it became incremental. I then went to Maldives because some people said they had seen the plane landing there. And again, that did not work. So I think I became hooked a year after when I realized just by doing this investigative, but it was still for a newspaper. So it was not yet the level of investigation you can do when you write a book, but it was already quite good enough to make me understand that I was dealing with a big problem.
Since you wrote the book and sort of published your own conclusions, which do say or suggest the plane went missing in northern Vietnam and not in the Indian Ocean, as the official narrative suggests, what, if anything, has changed for you? Have there been any developments that confirmed or challenged your conclusions? How closely are you still following this?
I'm still working on it because in the meantime, there have been a few documentaries and people continue to read my book. And I'm still contacted, I would say, almost every day by different people. I mean, most of them don't add much to the conversation, but some do. And as far as what I have better understood since the book was published 3 years ago, number one, I am more adamant than ever before that the plane never crashed in the Southern Indian Ocean. And, you know, I don't mind being wrong. I wouldn't be happy to have been completely misled and made the wrong assessment, etc. But if I had been offered a serious evidence that I was wrong, I would obviously accept it. But on the contrary, every extra information I received confirmed this. Every information I received since, and I met new people who knew also very well Captain Zahari, and again, they confirmed to me that he was a super reliable, good man, excellent pilot, and that he would never have been the source of whatever nefarious and tragic fate the plane encountered. And so I still believe that the plane got intercepted more or less around 2:40. Just to remind everyone, at 1:19 is more or less when the plane signs off and says goodnight. And at 1:20, it comes off in the morning, the radar screens. And so Malaysia Airlines said during its first 6 press statements that they lost contact at 2:40, which means 1 hour and 20 minutes later, and not 6 or 7 hours later by the time the plane would have been in Australia. The original, at the beginning, it was 2:40. And so I'm still convinced something happened around that time and there, but I almost have more doubts than before on what exactly happened as to the very end of the plane.
In terms of the cause of what happened at that point, yeah. Well, finally, Florence, just looking now 10 years later, I wonder if you do feel that we are any closer to either than finding out what really happened, what the cause was at 2:40 or at any other point, or getting some sort of recognition from the authorities in Vietnam, China, Australia, all the countries that were involved, Malaysia, that perhaps things did not go the way they suspected?
I think it very much depends who you ask. I feel much closer to the truth, and I am confident that truth will prevail and will appear. But at the same time, I can't deny the fact that public opinion in general knows less and less what happened to MH370, because there has been a very efficient, I mean, I don't know if it's orchestrated, but it is so well done and so timely and so well paced that it looks as if it is orchestrated, because some big media have repeatedly and almost 3 months, 6 months, you see a new breaking story about MH370, and any of this story, which each time is a little bit different, will promote either the crash in the Southern Indian Ocean or the guilty pilot or both. And with this very heavy load and relentless campaign of repeating this lie, I think that most of the public opinion by now, the people who are not interested, who have not read my book or did not follow closely, they have somewhere in their brain planted the idea that it was the pilot somehow or and it crashed in the Southern Indian Ocean. But that doesn't stop me from trying to find the truth and to being very hopeful that there will be some decent people who share, who carry part of the secret, because it's not a mystery anymore, it's a secret, and will share it out of their conscience, basically, and eventually the truth will come out. Someone asked me if we will find the plane, and my answer to that is I don't think we will find the plane anymore, but I think we'll find the truth.
Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9. Right.
And that was Florence Tshongi there. You can hear more from her in a special edition of the Monocle Weekly this Friday on the anniversary of MH370's disappearance. You're with Monocle Radio. 8:39 in Zurich, 7:39 here in London. Now, there are not many joyful chapters in Afghanistan's recent history, but one happened late last year. The national cricket team, nicknamed the Blue Tigers, outperformed all expectations at the 2023 World Cup in India, defeating the former champions Pakistan, Sri Lanka and England, and pushing Australia to the brink. Well, now the ruling Taliban in Afghanistan are planning to build a cricket stadium in the country. And to tell us more, I'm joined now by Lynn O'Donnell, columnist for Foreign Policy magazine. A very good morning to you, Lynn.
Hi.
So before we move on to the story of the new stadium, just recap the hugely successful tale of the Blue Tigers.
Oh, well, yeah, the Blue Tigers are Afghanistan's national cricket team. There's a lot of myth around cricket being a national sport for Afghanistan. It's not really. It's a Pashtun sport, and it's played mostly by young Pashtun men who are refugees in refugee camps in Pakistan, have fled Afghanistan with their families or even being born in Pakistan from the Soviet war and from the Taliban war that, as you know, lasted until 2021. So they've come out of Pakistan's cricketing success and obsession, really. And yes, they have been very successful. And throughout the 20 years of American and NATO occupation of Afghanistan, sport was very much encouraged and funded by the International Cricket Council. And so Afghanistan's cricket team became very, very good. They're now a full test team in the ICC rankings, which puts them alongside, as you said, Australia, England, Bangladesh, Pakistan and all the other, Sri Lanka, the other test-playing nations. And yes, now and then they do exceed expectations, but they've still got a long way to go. When they do win, as they did, as you said last week, that humiliating defeat of England, especially last year, who were the champions, perception is that the country explodes and it's a joyful occasion. But the fact is that it's not a national team. It's ethnically rooted with the Pashtun population, which is from whence the Taliban spring.
Indeed, and because of this connection with the ethnic Pashtun communities, does this mean that the Taliban has a more natural understanding of cricket and as a result is happier to promote the sport?
I think you're right there, Emma. Also, it's an opportunity for the Taliban to use sport to wash their own reputation worldwide. As we know, since they have taken over control of the country, women have been totally locked out of playing sport at all. They're not even allowed to go to gyms. They're not allowed to walk in parks. And this did inspire the Australians initially a couple of years ago to say that they were not going to play Afghanistan. And then, of course, when it came to the crunch, boycott melted away, and they did play against Afghanistan in the World Cup in India last year because they get points that way. And it was their decision, the Australian Cricket Board's decision not to play Afghanistan because of the way women are locked out of sport, was very widely welcomed. And then all of a sudden, it looks like it's going to affect the team. The boycott doesn't matter anymore. So, you know, cricket for the Taliban is potentially a way of getting the world to come to them. And this building of a cricket stadium, I think, plays into that ambition.
So tell us a little bit more about this stadium, where it will be and what it will be used for. I mean, you mentioned that it will be a sort of Taliban example of potential soft power.
Well, there are already cricket stadiums in Afghanistan. I haven't seen anything that says that the plans have been drawn up or the budget put aside for it. I think it's just more argy-bargy from the Taliban leadership trying to get attention. At the moment, we can say that sports stadiums are being repurposed as execution grounds. Just in the last couple of weeks alone, there have been five public executions carried out at sports stadiums. And the stadium in Kabul was also used during the last Taliban regime from 1990 2006, I think it was, to 2001 as an execution ground. So the question is, build them and they will come? I don't know about that. People that I've spoken to over the last couple of days about whether or not international cricket would be played at a stadium that the Taliban might build in Kabul have said no way. I mean, the ICC, the International Cricket Council, might be willing to channel a couple of million dollars a year to Afghanistan to ostensibly develop its cricket team. But I think the optics of international cricket teams going to Kabul and playing in stadiums in a country ruled by a regime that uses sports stadiums for arbitrary executions is just too poor. I can't see anybody doing that, to be honest, Emma.
And domestically, I mean, in a country which is absolutely impoverished, how will this cricket stadium be built?
Well, you know, the last time I was in Afghanistan, there were one or two in Kabul. I can say that there were one or two construction sites where unemployed men lined up from the early hours of the morning hoping to get some day labour. There's no work. If there was work building a sports stadium anywhere in the country, they'd certainly find labourers to do it because they've got nothing else to do and there's no other way of making money. It's not just poverty, it's abject unemployment. The Taliban have not made the transition from insurgents and terrorists into government by developing an economy and creating jobs. So there certainly would be people to build it, but I don't think there'd be anybody to come.
Lynna Donald, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
We head to France now, where the issue of abortion has made the headlines. Strangely, some might say, because this year marks a half century since it was legalised. But the country is taking steps to enshrine women's rights to termination in the constitution, making it a world first. I'm joined now by Agnès Parier, who's journalist and author of Notre Dame, the Soul of France. Very good morning to you, Agnès.
Good morning.
So last week, French senators voted to enshrine access to abortion in the constitution. So what happens today that's different?
Well, what happens today is that both the upper house of parliament, the Senate, and the lower house of parliament, the National Assembly, are meeting. We call it a Congress, and they are meeting. So that's, you know, a lot of people, 925 MPs and senators meeting in Versailles, because there's more room to for gathering and welcoming them all in Versailles, and they will vote together on that historic day to enshrine the freedom, the guaranteed freedom, this is the term, of women to abort in the constitution, in the Article 34. In effect, it's a revision of the constitution, and it's something that is extremely rare. And as you said, France will be, should be, later today, the first country to do so, and probably not the last one. There's hope that it will open, a series of revision of constitutions in other countries and certainly in Europe.
Now, the reason for this being brought about and placed so in such an important part of the French legal doctrine is a direct connection to what happened in the United States a couple of years ago, isn't it? That's even mentioned in the bill.
Oh, yes. I mean, because you could argue, of course, that France is a country where women can safely abort and there is no risk, actually, that this freedom be curtailed at some point in the future. I mean, none of the political party, unlike in other countries, are actually against abortion, not even the extreme right. But nothing is certain, especially these days. And to see that allied countries such as the US, where I think it's 21 states have rescinded partially or fully the right to abort for women, and a country in Europe, Poland, of course, has banned abortion, which made a lot of French women seek, you know, help from President Macron, saying, well, actually, we know we're not anytime soon in France going to discuss the right of women to abort, but you never know. And it would be great to enshrine it in the constitution. So, and President Macron said, yes, let's do that. And also, you know, it's in a country that is so divided, it's a rare moment of national unity, because the latest poll shows that 86% of the French people are in favor of that move. So it will, you know, later today, I think it will be around 6 p.m. and a big screen will broadcast live the speeches and the vote in Paris, just opposite the Eiffel Tower on the Trocadero place. And I'm sure it will be streamed live in on a lot of channels throughout the world.
Tell me a little bit more about the politics around this. I mean, you say it's a moment of national unity, but there are questions being made about the, not just the fact that it is being done, which is widely accepted as a sort of a sensible move, but the reasons behind it. There's some were saying that this is Emmanuel Macron trying to boost left-wing credentials, flush out opposition to abortion. But also on the other side of the political spectrum, they're saying that Emmanuel Macron talks about lowering fertility rates, wanting the country to have more children, which is emboldening the anti-abortionists. In a country, am I right in thinking that France has the highest birth rate of all in the EU? It's not smooth sailing completely, is it?
Well, I would say it is, because those are peripheral issues. First of all, I mean, the president will always be reproached or suspected of, you know, being political and trying to veer on the left after having veered on the right, you know, on the topics such as immigration. I mean, that's the eternal predicament of a centrist, having to veer left or right and being reproached for doing so each time by the opposite side. Now, on the question of fertility, I think it's a different thing, because President Macron, yes, demography, in France is not going in the right direction, because we have a very generous redistribution wealth system, which is based on a healthy fertility rate. And what President Macron is trying to do is to actually make it easier and make it also profitable for women to have more children. That is to say, to provide state aid for crèche and for supporting women going back to work, even though they might have, you know, choose to have more children. So it's not really, it does not infringe, if you'd like, on the fundamental right and now guaranteed freedom of women to abort.
Agnès Pannier in Paris, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, on today's programme, it's time to talk architecture and design with Tim Abrahams, who's contributing editor at Architectural Record. A very good morning to you, Tim.
Good morning, Emma. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And excited to hear about your travels to the Geneva Motor Show.
Yes, the Geneva Motor Show has just finished this weekend. It was an interesting event. I'm not sure it was the fullest or the most dynamic in the august history of the Geneva Motor Show. The motor industry is going through a huge period of flux at the moment, particularly with how it accepts or deals with electric vehicles. So there was a sense of trepidation, shall we say, at the show. Although there were some amazing products being lined up, the most amazing is possibly the the stand that everyone was really looking at was the Chinese EV giant BYD, who put forward two concept vehicles, one of which is an amazing sports car, Yangwang U9, which is $233,000 if you want one. Very special, very flash, very electric. But the interesting one as well was its sister car, which was a floating SUV. That's right. If you ditch it in a river, it won't sink.
Indeed. I mean, there is that great question of how often does one find oneself in a situation when one has ditched in a lake?
Well,
I mean, in Geneva, there's possibly a higher chance than in other places.
there's a very beautiful example to give it a go on. I wouldn't necessarily want to do it. It's a very, very enclosed space. One of my colleagues, James McLaughlin, who works for the Car Design News, likened it to being in a ceramic pot. So whilst you might be ready for the most extreme eventualities, it's not necessarily the most convivial of normal driving circumstances.
No, it's not. And given the fact that I've neither ditched my car in a lake, nor have I been in a large ceramic pot, I'm just finding this is rather a difficult thing when the Geneva Motor Show needs to hit the headlines. But in terms of design, how relevant is all this?
Well, I mean, you can only represent the truth of the industry as an expo site, and Geneva is having a great deal of difficulty trying to reconcile European car manufacturers to what's happening in the rest of the world. Now, the Chinese manufacturers are coming on board. What happened is you have big manufacturers like Fiat not turning up at all. But then you also have moments there where the real thing that kind of lifted everybody was the Renault 5 E-Tech, which was launched about in 21 as a concept car, but now looks like the first really bold statement by a European car manufacturer into the EV market. It's a genuinely exciting car, both appealing to fans of the old vehicle and new ones looking forward to a really interesting driving experience with an electric vehicle. It's got all of the tricks that the design tricks that the old car have, gently smiling front eyes from the 1972 model, vertical rear lights, wide shoulders, a really exciting moment. So there are moments of optimism for the future, but as it stands, the event really did the current condition is not exactly positive, although there are glimpses of the future.
We have but a minute to talk about Porto, much beloved here at Monocle. And there's a very good reason for that, because it's suddenly become a place to go if you love modernism.
It's a beautiful, beautiful story. Alvaro Siza, who is one perhaps the world, you could argue, one of the world's greatest living architects, a huge figure in the evolution of the country following the revolution in the 70s, who brought beautiful mass housing to the country. And he has just opened the new Alvaro Siza wing has just opened at the Serralves Museum, which was designed by Siza. And not only is this an Alvaro Siza extension to an Alvaro Siza original, it's also hosting an exhibition about Alvaro Siza. So if you really want to kind of appreciate him, there's only one place in the world to be at the moment. And the exhibition is open until August the 24th in 2024. I'm going. I haven't been yet, but it's a kind of must, I think.
Tim Abrams, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to the producers Vincent McAvinney, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Laura Kramer. Our researcher was Naomi Ekwe and our studio manager was Mariella Bevan, with editing assistance from Lily Austin. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The briefing is live at midday here in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. Hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening and have a great week.